ॐ सहना भवतु सहनो भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा द्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. May the Supreme Lord protect both the teacher and the student, and may He cherish and nourish us both. May we work with full energy, may our study be perfect, and may it give us good results. May we never feel ill will towards others. Good to see you back. Hope you all survived the fasting and the feasting and all of that. Today I'd like to do a number of things, so I hope you'll bear with me. Today's theme was pretty much covered in the chapter we studied last week, chapter 4. So I'd like to deal with that quite briefly. Then I'd like to do some work on mood and mission. I'd ask you to do some prep reading for that. I also wanted to tell you the outcome of the final meeting for the exam format, so it's very clear to you what that situation would be. And share with you an idea I had for preparation for the exam. One thing that is worrying me is that we have a lot of creative intelligence in this group, but we also have limitations in terms of English not being the first language, and even those who have English as a first language may not be familiar with the written word so much, in terms of how to write an essay, how to formulate questions and the answers to the questions like that. So I'm really concerned that you don't be penalized for those lack of skills in the exams. Unfortunately, the exam will be all written. So although I can see that caliber is there, somehow or other we have to get the skill up to a standard where you'll be able to express what you have to offer. So I wanted to discuss some ideas that I had to maybe help with that. And the final thing that I wanted to discuss, which shouldn't take more than 5 minutes, is the situation with the Vaishnav etiquette course that will be taking up Saturday and Sunday this coming weekend. So my personal experience of India is, in the West you can push yourself and you can achieve and you can go on. But my personal experience of India is that if you push yourself, you just get very sick and it takes a long time to recover. So I have a couple of suggestions there of how we could deal with it, because I know that some devotees were very inspired and enlivened by the course. So we want to have a look at how we'll deal with that, practically speaking. So these four things I'd like to do today, if that's okay. So the first thing we'll do is have a look at number three B theme, how to receive knowledge. As I said, I'll deal with this quite briefly, because we dealt with it at quite some length in our chapter 4 study last week. Can anyone tell me where they feel this would be situated within the analysis that we gave at the beginning? We had Sambandha Bidaya Prayojana, this thematic analysis scheme. Where do you feel this one would fit into in relation to that? Any clues? You always know. Let's have somebody else. Anybody else have an idea? Yeah. Thank you. Very nice. Abhideya. Okay. It's part of the process. In particular, it's process of sadhana bhakti, one of the subdivisions that Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives for Abhideya. So today's theme is within the realm of Abhideya, so devotional service in practice, and the process of that. So we'll just take a walk through the conceptual flow. Most of the principles that we need to know are here. As we say in the beginning, in the fourth chapter, Krishna introduces the fundamental principles for receiving transcendental knowledge. He introduces the importance of bona fide parampara, the importance of surrendering to a bona fide guru, and to serving him, inquiring from him appropriately. So all of these things are mentioned very early, or actually most of them are mentioned very early on in the fourth chapter. And then if you remember, In verse 39 of this fourth chapter, the further qualification was given. Someone who wants to receive transcendental knowledge, they should be faithful. They should be dedicated to gaining this transcendental knowledge, and they should have control of their senses. These three things were added as further qualification in verse 39 of chapter 4. We get a little bit of a further glimpse in the 7th chapter, first verse, where Krishna stresses the importance of hearing. Of course, if we want to learn something, we have to hear. And we have to hear with an open heart. And we have to hear from bona fide source. So in essence, that means from Krishna or his bona fide representative in Parampara. In verse 1 of chapter 9, Krishna looks at a subtle aspect of this hearing process. He mentions that one cannot be non-envious if he wants to learn. So we have to be hearing, but hearing with a non-envious attitude. That means we're not challenging the guru, we're not trying to assess his quality by our questions, but rather that our mood is properly submissive. Not blindly submissive, but appropriately submissive. And then in verses 8 to 12 of chapter 13, Prabhupada explains the importance of humility. If we're proud, then we think we know it all. So how can anybody teach us anything? Isn't it? But if we are aware of our weaknesses, we're both aware of our anattas and our lack of knowledge, then we can go to somebody and say, I have these limitations. You're expert in this field. Can you help me? So humility is a very essential quality for acquiring knowledge. In terms of the working process of achieving knowledge, this abhidhaya, also in these verses, Prabhupada in his purport points out the two essential features. One is that we have to be under the care of a bona fide spiritual master. We have to take diksha from him, and we also have to be taking proper siksha from him. And the other aspect is that we have to be favorably performing devotional service, because it's these two together that light the fire in the heart and burn up the impurities. So both aspects need to be there. The acceptance of a bona fide guru and practice of favorable devotional service under his guidance. So all of these things are mentioned by Prabhupada. So a couple of other points that I'll make that I've mentioned in the thematic overview essay. Essential point is that this transcendental knowledge descends from Krishna through the disciplic succession. We could say that's a given. It is a given, but we may forget it's such a given that we may forget to mention it in an essay. It's a very basic point, but we may forget to mention it because it's so basic. We think everybody knows that. But in an essay, we assume that nobody knows anything, so we write everything that we know. Also, in his purport to 434, Prabhupada gives us a clue how we can quickly advance in devotional service. What is the real secret? He explains that pleasing the guru, this is the quickest way to get knowledge. Just by pleasing the Bhagavat, we will get knowledge of Krishna. Excuse me? It's in the purport to 434. Prabhupada's purport to 434. It's in the fourth paragraph of the essay. Also, I've mentioned it there. So these are the main points that we would need to raise. It's a very simple, straightforward thing. These are the main points that we would need to raise in discussing it. Does anybody have any questions about this theme? Yeah? Yeah. Actually, because it's so basic, we think not to mention it, but it's better that we do. And that is that transcendental knowledge comes down from Krishna. He is the source of the knowledge. comes down from Krishna through the parampara to us. Not that there's other, some other source or some other medium for receiving it. It's an essential aspect of receiving bona fide knowledge. Anything else on the theme? So that's okay? No questions? Okay, good. Most of it we covered last week, so it's not really so much need to go into it further. If you have further questions, you can always ask me later. So let's have a look at mood and mission. One thing I did want to read to you on this receiving knowledge. I found it very nice. It's a commentary on 4.7, the verse 4.7 from Bhagavad Gita. Wherever there is a decline in religious practice, O descendant of Bharata, and a predominant rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. It's a comment on that verse that Prabhupada gives in Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's in Madhya Lila, chapter 6, the purport to 255. I'd just like to read it to you because I feel that in terms of understanding of our position and personal application, it's very useful. So this verse is first stated, quoted by Prabhupada, whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious practice, O descendant of Bharata, and a predominant rise of religion, at that time I descend myself. And then Prabhupada says, this is also the case with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's appearance. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in this world as a disguised incarnation of Krishna, but his appearance is confirmed in Srimad Bhagavatam, the Mahabharata, and other Vedic scriptures. He appeared in order to teach the fallen souls in this material world, for in this age of Kali, almost everyone has become attached to fruitive and ritualistic activities and mental speculation. Consequently, there was a great need to revive the system of devotional service. The Lord himself personally came down disguised as a devotee so that the fallen populace might take advantage of the Lord's example. At the conclusion of the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna advised complete surrender unto him, promising all protection to his devotee. Unfortunately, people are so fallen that they cannot accept the instructions of Lord Krishna. Therefore, Krishna returned with the same mission, but he executed it in a different way. As Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he ordered us to surrender to himself. But as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he taught us how to surrender to Krishna. Therefore, he is praised by the Goswamis, Namo Mahavadanya Krishna Prema Pradayate. Lord Sri Krishna is certainly the personality of Godhead, but he is not as magnanimous as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Lord Krishna simply gave orders for one to become his devotee, Mammana Bhavamad Bhakta. But Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu actually taught the process of devotional service. If one wants to become a devotee of Krishna, he must first take shelter of the lotus feet of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I just thought it was a very nice comment on this whole process of knowledge. Okay, so with the mood and mission, we asked you to take a look at page 30 of your handbook, where the objectives to the different aims are given. So we may have an aim that is common. Usually we have an aim when we want to achieve something, but objectives are equally important. Objective means that thing by which I can test whether I am achieving the aims. So the objectives for the aims of mood and mission is given on page 30. I'd like to have a look at those with you. If there, as we read through each one, if you don't understand it, then please let me know so we can discuss it a little further for clarity. Page 30 of your handbook. So here, the student should be able to explain how a verse, purport, or statement relates to and or reflects Srila Prabhupada's mood and mission. Okay? So you may see a verse in Bhagavad Gita, a purport in Bhagavad Gita, and from reading that, it reminds you of something about Prabhupada's mood. Here we're talking transcendental personality, or about the specific flavor of Prabhupada's mission. For example, Rukmavati, where we were discussing a verse in the fourth chapter, raised the point that Prabhupada is always taking everything back to the chanting of Hare Krishna. So this is an observation of Prabhupada's mission, that he is, this is a specific aspect of his mission, like that. Is there any questions on that point, or is that point quite clear? It's okay? I'm not sure whether you're tired from the weekend and here physically, but everybody's asleep, or everybody's transcendentally realized this morning. You have a question, Yashoda? No, it's another book. It's the student's handbook. Yeah? Do you have that? It's another one. Yeah, we have a lot of bombardment by paper this year. But if you can get it from Subal, he'll be more than happy to give it to you, and it's on page 30. Tosi, you had a question? No, that's our assessment of him. That is not his mood. Prabhupada doesn't have the mood, I am a great devotee. That's our mood towards him. No, we're not talking about that. Here we're talking about Prabhupada's mood, Prabhupada's mission, special thing, special flavor of that. What I'd like to do, we'll go through these points, and then we'll look at particular purports. And by studying those purports in light of these points, then we will practically understand what we're talking. Yeah, but we can't do it. We can't do it like that. There's one reason we can't do it like that, and that is because we all have our own Prabhupada. You know, Prabhupada is like a Vaduya gem, like a very special jewel, and there are many, many sides to such a jewel. Okay, so that your Prabhupada will be different than my Prabhupada. What attracts you to Prabhupada and what keeps you at his feet will be different than my experience of Prabhupada. I'd like to do it more personally. I think when we start to discuss different purports, you'll get the idea. If you're still confused after doing that, then please raise it again. We'll have another discussion about it. But the important thing for me is that we do realize that Prabhupada is not a static person. He's a transcendental person. And our relationship with him will be an individual thing. There would be, for example, I notice it most strongly when, for example, I read Hari Sori's diary and then I read Shruti Kirti's. When I read Hari Sori Prabhu's diary, I get the idea that Prabhupada is a really heavy, like forceful, he's got it all together sort of person. And then I read Shruti Kirti's Prabhu's diaries, his notes, and I get this feeling that Prabhupada is just a loving, sweet-natured person. You know? Because they have different perspectives. You know, Hari Sori and Shruti Kirti Prabhu are very, very different people. And they relate to Prabhupada. You know, we have a relationship with Prabhupada. And that relationship will be different. Because we're all different. Is that okay? Any other questions on this first point? No? Okay, let's have a look at the second one. Explain how Srila Prabhupada's translations and purports give insight into his mission and that of ISKCON. I think this is pretty clear. Basically, what is that being said here is that sometimes when you read a purport, it gives a very clear idea of a certain aspect of Prabhupada's mission. Isn't it? We find it there. Again, I use the example of Rukmavati when she raised the thing of Nam being an essential aspect, highlight Prabhupada's mission. Is it okay? It's very similar. Very similar. I haven't covered the next two points. I don't think they're relevant at this level of study. So we'll go down to point five. Apply scripture to compare and contrast attitudes and behavior worthy of the members of ISKCON with those which are inappropriate. Said very simply, that means sometimes we read something where Prabhupada is giving a very clear indication of what should be the standard. Isn't it? He gives a very clear standard. This, if you are a devotee, this should be done like that. So from that statement, we can understand what to do and what not to do. Just another aspect of Prabhupada's mission, which is to train us up as pure devotees. Any questions on that point? Was it pretty clear? Okay. Next one, identify how Srila Prabhupada's personal qualities relate to scripture. This is a very sweet topic. It's just that the more you study Prabhupada's books, the more you can understand how he is a manifestation of Shastra. He's a living Bhagavat, isn't it? So the living Bhagavat, he's living the Shastra. And that becomes very clear by studying Prabhupada's books, how Prabhupada is doing that. Last point, determine the role that Srila Prabhupada's books play in furthering his mission and in the lives of his followers. So it's not really necessary for us to determine that, because it's already determined by the process we follow, that Prabhupada is the founder of Charya, he is the main Siksha Guru, these books are the guiding light for us as individual devotees, as well as for the movement for the next 10,000 years. So we can understand the weight of importance of the books from this. You can look at that from a number of angles of vision. In one sense, you can say that hearing from Prabhupada's, like reading Prabhupada's books, is none different than hearing from him. That it is the hearing process, especially if you read his books out loud. It's very, very powerful. But then there's another angle of vision which we can understand from Kapiladeva's teachings in the third canto of Bhagavatam, where he explains that although devotional service is pure, it can't be contaminated. Those who practice it, they may not be pure. So he explains that there are 81 different kinds of consciousness that can approach devotional service according to the mixture of the modes. And it's like our mind, our consciousness, is like a computer program, right? So if you have a particular computer program, it will only take out certain information from the computer. So in a similar way, if, for example, your consciousness is very much contaminated by the lower mode of ignorance, then when you read Prabhupada's books, you will only take out that information that sort of suits you, how you're feeling about things, isn't it? If you're into issues, then you may not see the philosophical flow of the book, but you'll see the points that support your idea on the issues, things like that. So there's a number of different ways you can see it. I personally experience both of them. So most often I feel that I'm hearing from Prabhupada when I'm reading his books. It's what's kept me very strong in the movement. His mercy in that way has kept me very, you know, solidly fixed. But I'm also aware that sometimes I can feel very clearly, or even sometimes I'm not aware of it, but somebody else points it out to me, that you've misunderstood that point. And I can understand, yes, because of the modes that are covering me. So the ideal situation is if you're regularly hearing Prabhupada's books, but you've got someone that you trust as a senior, is of like mind, that when you're not sure about something you read or you want another angle on it, you can go to them and say, well, what do you think about this? Then it's perfect. Then you've got a good balance. Is that okay? Got something else to add? It doesn't have to be an issue. You just have to be aware that in spiritual life, we're not dealing with black and white. It's not either this or that. You have to look at it from different perspectives. I think it's a bit fairer than that. We're basically, in this course, we're mainly looking at your understanding of what you're reading. You may not have realized it, but you may have a theoretical understanding of it. You may have some idea of how to apply it in your life, in your preaching. And the knowledge and recall is basically just whether you know what's in Prabhupada's books. So, you know, I mean, I'm not one to test your realization. Because what is my level of realization is also a point, isn't it? So, like, when it gets to things like testing somebody's realization or testing somebody's faith, I tend to step out of the picture and leave it to somebody else to deal with. Because I don't feel it's something that I could, with integrity, do. I don't feel it's within my realm to do that. I'm not at that level of consciousness. So what we're dealing with in the papers and things is more in terms of what you know from Prabhupada's books, what you understand from Prabhupada's books, a little bit of an idea of how you could apply it personally and like that. Not so much testing faith or testing realization. That's a personal thing for you to deal with, really. And yeah, from your angle of vision, you're looking at it in terms of just the process, the practical process. I don't have any trouble with that. Yeah, that's why I raised that if we can have both, it's best. In small temples, that's difficult because you may not have someone that you can go to and discuss things with. But, yeah, you can write, calm them. Put something decent on calm for a change. Yeah, that sharing is very important. The other alternative is to give those devotees a chance when there's like conferences going on in Radhadesh or somewhere. Give them a chance to go and be part of it. Yeah. Yeah, I like the idea that you're suggesting that that balance should be there. That's the healthiest situation. Okay. Anything else on that? So let's have a look. We'll just have a look at a couple of purports that are very, very obvious. What's happening in them. Let's have a look at 212. That's the first one. You may find others also. I'm just bringing these up. So this is a very famous verse which Prabhupada lectured on regularly. 212. Chapter 2, verse 12. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So if we remember Prabhupada's second pranam, it makes a very clear statement about the essence of his mission, that he wanted to defeat, or he was given the responsibility to defeat impersonalism and voidism. So in this purport, this mood of Prabhupada and this mission of Prabhupada comes up very, very strongly. Throughout the purport, he is making it very clear that the Mayavadis are improperly informed in their understanding of verses like this one. Let's have a look, for example, at the third paragraph. It begins the Mayavad theory. The Mayavadi theory that after liberation, the individual soul, separated by the covering of Maya or illusion, will merge into the impersonal Brahman and lose its individual existence, is not supported herein by Lord Krishna, the supreme authority. So this is a very wonderful statement that shows us clearly the two things. Prabhupada's mood, not that he's saying that they're wrong, but rather the supreme authority, Krishna, says they're wrong. So this is a clear indication of an aspect of Prabhupada's mood, that he doesn't say, I think you're wrong. He says, according to the supreme authority, this Krishna, this is not proper. So this is very, very prevalent as a mood of Prabhupada. And also in terms of his mission, which is a large part of it, is to defeat impersonalism and voidism, is also here giving those who are innocent and who are pious, those who read his books, some ammunition. Okay, these guys are wrong. These Mayavadis are not doing the right thing. So he goes on, most of the purport, he's talking about that. Maybe we'll read a little bit more so you get a clearer picture of what we're talking about. Krishna clearly says herein that in the future also the individuality of the Lord and others, as is confirmed in the Upanishads, will continue eternally. This statement of Krishna's is authoritative, because Krishna cannot be subject to illusion. If individuality were not a fact, then Krishna would not have stressed it so much, even for the future. The Mayavadi may argue that the individuality spoken of by Krishna is not spiritual, but material. Even accepting the argument that individuality is material, then how can one distinguish Krishna's individuality? Krishna affirms his individuality in the past and confirms his individuality in the future also. He has confirmed his individuality in many ways. An impersonal Brahman has been declared to be subordinate to him. Krishna has maintained spiritual individuality all along. If he is accepted as an ordinary conditioned soul, an individual consciousness, then his Bhagavad Gita has no value as authoritative scripture. A common man with all the four defects of human frailty is unable to teach that is which is worth hearing. The Gita is above such literature. No mundane book compares with the Bhagavad Gita. When one accepts Krishna as an ordinary man, the Gita loses all importance. The Mayavadi argues that the plurality mentioned in this verse is conventional and that it refers to the body. But previous to this verse, such a bodily conception is already condemned. After condemning the bodily conception of the living entities, how was it possible for Krishna to place a conventional proposition on the body again? Therefore, individuality is maintained on spiritual grounds and is thus confirmed by great acharyas like Sri Ramanuja and others. So these are strong points that Prabhupada is making here. You catching what I'm saying as an indication of the mission of Prabhupada? Any doubt? You look a bit worried, Bettina. Would like to express your doubts or worries? Yeah. This is just a little aspect of Prabhupada's mood, that he will always support what he says with Shastra. He will never say, I think. He'll always say, according to Krishna, according to Madhvacharya, according to my Guru Maharaj, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. He'll always quote and support his position like that. And then what I went on to say was different aspects of his argument against Mayavadism that are very prevalent in this purport in particular. We'll find that this comes up quite a lot because it is a very strong part of Prabhupada's mission to defeat impersonalism. Because if we don't defeat impersonalism, then people are not inclined towards spiritual life. If I'm not going to be a person, if everything's finished when I leave my body, then I might as well just enjoy now. So it tends to increase that hedonistic tendency, that desire just to stay on the planet and enjoy and then just drop everything. So it's a very essential point to enliven people by telling them, no, you have eternal individuality. You're eternally a person, an individual person. So Prabhupada is sort of making these kind of points in the purport. Yeah. 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 So that those who are innocent and read his books, they'll get a proper understanding of what he's saying, of the actual situation. Is it okay? They really twist them. Because that's the nature of Sanskrit. It's such a subtle language. It's actually a perversion of Krishna Leela. Because in Radha Krishna Leela, and even in the relationship between the gopas and Krishna, quite often a whole pastime will evolve from them understanding different words to mean different things. You know, it's very many of them are mentioned in Nectar of Devotion, or not many, but a few of them are mentioned in Nectar of Devotion as example. So when the perversion comes down here, you have the Mayavadis and the impersonalists sort of, you know, breaking the words in certain ways to give completely opposite meanings. It's possible with Sanskrit because of the subtlety. The Prabhupada is always... He's always quoting authority. This is actually a sign of a devotee. Second point... Also his own logic. Like this whole purport, it's a very long purport, is an expansion of the verse according to Prabhupada's realization. So he is here explaining exactly what Prabhupada is meaning by this verse. The Mayavadis have a completely different understanding of this verse. So they have a completely different understanding. They say that this means, here we're only talking about Krishna, when he, you know, they say that when Krishna comes into the material realm, he's covered by three modes. He makes it a material body. So they see it completely differently. So Prabhupada is presenting the pure bhakti position here. Is that it? I want you to explore this yourself. There will be guidance, but I want you to explore this yourself. And from this week, to the generative questions that I gave you to govern your reading, that you do at night for homework, I want you to add one question, which is there anything in this purport that gives me some understanding of Prabhupada's mood or Prabhupada's mission or both? Because if you shape your consciousness and your awareness in this way, you'll find that much of what is said is giving you information that builds your understanding of Prabhupada as a spiritual personality, as a founder acharya of this movement, as a preacher. I want you to develop this skill yourself. So if you can kindly add that question to your list of homework questions. Is there anything in this purport that tells me more about Prabhupada's mood or Prabhupada's mission? Then you'll find, although it feels a little uncomfortable at the moment, just by practicing reading in this light, you'll find that your understanding of Prabhupada will grow quite considerably. No. You know who have the general questions I gave you about what should guide your reading? Anything I don't understand? What is the main point like that? What was that? I'm just adding one more. The one that I'm adding is there anything in this purport that gives me an idea, more of an idea of Prabhupada's mood or mission? It's just an added point, not something, a whole new thing. We're trying to build our relationship with Prabhupada. Yes, of course. It has to be. It's essential. It's essential for your healthy relationship with Prabhupada. Oh, this is your Guru Maharaj's perspective. This is actually your Guru Maharaj's perspective. And I agree with it. That Prabhupada, when he's giving his commentary, he's giving it as someone in Gaudiya line. And he's giving it from the essential perspective. There's another angle of vision we can look on it, and that is that Prabhupada is a unique personality. He is not just another acharya. He's the acharya after Vyasadeva who has come to propagate this movement for Mahaprabhu for the next 10,000 years. So of course he is going to give the essence. You know, he's going to give the essence. And he's not going to leave any room for doubt about what he's talking about. This is why I get a little bit concerned when people start quoting more his letters and conversations than his books. Because his letters and conversations are time, place, circumstance, adjustment. But the books are the law books. We should know the books best. The others add to give us an idea of how Prabhupada dealt with detail. But the books tell us the essence. So I agree with you. Actually, Sri Guru Maharaj's position, I agree with it. That, of course, he's going to be presenting it from the Gaudiya perspective. There are many Sanskrit scholars, I know some in Calcutta, they can't tolerate Prabhupada's books because they do a literary translation. You know, when they go through Prabhupada's word for word, they just about pull out their hair because they only know dictionary. They don't have any realization of Krishna or what he's trying to say. So, you know, they go word by word and they say, you know, can't read this book. But then, you know, like for us, you know, there's times when I'm glad I don't know Sanskrit so well. I can just take it Prabhupada is saying, you know. I accept his authority like that. Yeah. It's a fact. Actually, This is another very important thing to remember is that it's not the words on the page or in the air that change the heart. It's the chit shakti in the words that changes. It's that potency, that knowledge potency that is there. Because when we speak, if we're a pure devotee, when we speak, it's Krishna that comes through the words. It's that chit shakti that comes through the words. And that changes the heart. For the rest of us, or for myself at least, when you speak, there's dirt in the heart still. So that comes out with the words. You know, you may have to go and take a shower after you hear class. But with Prabhupada, it's the chit shakti, any pure devotee. And it's that chit shakti that sort of reverberates in the heart and changes it, cleans it up. But the other thing that, just in terms of Prabhupada's personality, I met one lady in Calcutta who was a Sanskrit scholar. She was a teacher at university. And she had personal contact with Prabhupada. And just to give an insight into how expert Prabhupada was in Sanskrit, he used to talk with her, regular conversation just in Sanskrit. So it's not that Prabhupada didn't know the language. Prabhupada was very expert. And she said that she was always amazed by his expertise and his fluency in Sanskrit, that he could just, you know, have conversations with her. Like we're having a conversation now. Prabhupada would have a conversation with her in Sanskrit because she was a Sanskrit major. You know. So I found that always very interesting. It was like that. Okay, so... it wasn't so much things that you had to note, but just to give you a sort of a bit of a broader idea of what I meant by mood. When we're talking mood, we have to remember there's a personality behind that mood. So then we see that, you know, we're looking at a transcendental personality. And one of the things I did mention that you maybe like to write down was that it means that he's living the Shastra. So a lot of the qualities that we see in him as a person are things that we read about in the books. You know what I mean? Like that. So that he's naturally living, spontaneously living the culture. You have book Bhagavat and you have person Bhagavat. Like that. Yeah. If you add this question to your homework list of questions for when you do your reading, you'll naturally start to get a taste for what we're talking about here. Just by having it as one of the questions that you apply when you do your reading. Is there anything in this purport that gives me some further idea of Prabhupada's mood and mission? I think it'll become... Yeah. That's a very nice observation. It's a very deep observation. This is one of the... that Prabhupada is not only describing Krishna, but he is giving us his Krishna. So this is a very, very wonderful point. Thank you for bringing it up. Because this is where chastity, our faithfulness, is so important. Because if we're not faithful to the person who is trying to give us Krishna, then the residents of Vrindavan are not going to be interested if we knock at the door. You know? We are in this line. Prabhupada has a certain mood. At all levels he has a certain mood. And he has his Krishna to give us. His own Krishna to give us. Very wonderful Krishna. So if you choose to go outside and hear from this Babaji and this Maharaj and all that kind of thing, it's going to break that flow. When you go, if you finally make it to the, you know, like the Kunj gate, the gopis are not going to ask you how many slokas you know from Bhagavad Gita. They're going to check out your faithfulness to your guru, to your parampara, because that's the whole world there. Faith means, in the essence, love, when we're talking spiritual love. So when you have that kind of faithfulness, then they're interested. If you can't be faithful here, ISKCON is a starting stone. ISKCON is the introduction to the principles of Golok Vrindavan. So if you can't get it right within ISKCON, how can you get it right there? First do it here. ISKCON, if you look at ISKCON structure, everything, it's all based on Golok standards. It's very interesting. It's not based on Vaikuntha standards. It's based on Golok. Even the GBC structure. It's very interesting. What are you going to say, Prabhu? Yeah. There's a brilliance in Prabhupada's presentation because he has come down here as the embodiment of Mahaprabhu's desire to spread this movement in a mass way in Kali Yuga. So although Prabhupada is criticized for it, it's actually one of his greatest... weapons in terms of dealing with the ignorance of Kali Yuga, in that he doesn't use the technical terms and things like that. He gives all the knowledge. Anyone who knows technical terms can immediately pick it up in the books. But those who are new to the movement, don't have much background, they can just relish the book. And they can be purified. They can identify with what he's saying. Okay, I want to move on if that's okay. Oh, yeah, okay. Two of you. Who's going to go first? Satyavati, you're first. What we had before we came to ISKCON is usually cleared out over time. the real thing comes through by Prabhupada's mercy. Yeah. Well, we can look at that from a number of angles of vision. I won't spend a lot of time on it because there's other things I want to discuss. But if you look at Golok, there are many camps, isn't it? And there's, except for when it's Ras, like Chandravali and Radhika's camps, you know, there's not fighting. Lalita Devi has her own gun. Vishakha has her own gun. Ranga Devi. No, they have their own group of servants, right? They have their own, sorry, I should use proper terms. They have their own group of servants. So it's not that they're fighting amongst groups. They're all serving the one personality, Srimati Radharani, who's actually the only devotee. We're all aspiring devotees, aspiring to be her servant. So, you know, like for someone who's mature in their Krishna consciousness, they're not going to see it as a problem that there are other groups, because that's even the way, it's just a reflection of what happens in the spiritual world. There are many spiritual groups, and they all have their part to play in pleasing Krishna, in serving the pastimes of Golok. The problem comes when there is an improper mood from either side, when there's not proper understanding of the culture that should be maintained. Then the problems come. And unfortunately, we don't have much culture. You know, we don't have a lot of culture. So these problems come. And quite frankly, I feel that a lot of the difficulties in ISKCON since 86 have been a result of aparad to other empowered pure devotees who are not part of ISKCON. They are empowered. They have their part to play in the mission, but they're not part of our mission. So if we, you know, if we have a full glass of milk, then ink can't enter into it, isn't it? So if we are fully absorbed, we have faith in Prabhupada, we're aware of our own anattas, we're making full endeavor to try and pure ourselves and come up to the standard that he's given, become fully integrated personalities, spiritual personalities, then we're not going to be too much concerned about issues or these other camps and all that sort of stuff. They're doing their thing, fine, let them do it, that's wonderful. But we're doing our thing. But there is another point on top of that, which is one that will take history to show. It will take time. At the moment, we're a little bit too close to really understand Prabhupada's position. Huh? Some of us may have some realization of this through different experiences in the preaching field and things like that. But Prabhupada is no ordinary pure devotee. And Prabhupada is no ordinary acharya. He's not even an ordinary founder acharya. When you look at what his work, even you analyze it with a cool head, you can see that he is the first one since Vyasadeva to do what Vyasadeva has done. He's basically, when you look at it like in a historical network, you can see that, okay, Vyasadeva was the first person to start to prepare the Vedas for Kali Yuga. Prabhupada is the second one in that network. The next one's not going to be for a lot of thousands of years, a lot of thousands of years. You know, but as Vyasadeva, he simplified things and decoded them. Prabhupada did the same thing. You know, I could talk about this for a long time because, you know, I've seen many angles of vision on it and I've talked to a lot of people about it. But it is a matter of, for now, for us now here, our faithfulness, to the extent that we are not blindly faithful, but are truly faithful, to that extent Prabhupada will reveal himself and his mission to us, and our part in his mission. And for the rest of us who are not wanting to do like that, we still want to maintain some independence from Prabhupada, wear ISKCON cloth, go to ISKCON programs, take the ISKCON feast, but we want to maintain a little bit of independence. But for that caliber of devotee, and I'm not criticizing them, I'm just saying that they're a different group, that caliber of devotee, they may need history to prove it to them, that Prabhupada is unique in his position in Kali Yuga preaching on behalf of Mahaprabhu. Is it okay? It's just... Yeah. A little bit louder. Yeah? Yes. That's a very strong part of his mission that is shown in this purport. Is that okay? You couldn't hear? She just wanted to clarify what aspect of the Prabhupada's mission was the dominant one in this verse we just looked at, the purport we just looked at, 2.12. So here we're talking Prabhupada's desire and purpose is to defeat impersonalism. This is the aspect. I think that's pretty clear. We will do some work on this. I can see we need to do some work on this, but there are two things I want to discuss further. One is the exam format. We had the last meeting with the teachers, all the teachers from the VAHE, to discuss that. I wanted to tell you about that. Pardon? Yeah. We will do that, but not right now. If we get time at the end, we'll go back. Is that okay? I'm sorry. I don't know. I don't seem to have a good hold on time in Vrindavan. Seems to slip away. But I'll talk about the exam format a little later. I want to talk about exam preparation first. As I mentioned at the beginning, one thing that is a little bit concerning me as a teacher is that I see that there is a lot of talent and a lot of intelligence in this group. But there are external limitations on that. One of them is lack of skill in writing, either because of second language or because of lack of training. You haven't gone to university or haven't been there for many years or whatever. So one thing that I thought of, and this is not to say it has to be done, it's just a thought I had. Whether you like it or not is up to you. It won't worry me if you don't like it. What I was thinking is that we have 5 weeks before our first Bhagavad Gita exams. I don't feel that I'm properly preparing you at this stage in terms of the actual doing of the test. I think that we're growing nicely and we're getting a lot of realizations, but in terms of preparation for the test, there's something left to be desired. So what I'm thinking we could do is from tomorrow not have the kirtan. Just do the Mangala Charana and the prayer from the Shani Panchakam. That way we save 10 minutes. I take 10 minutes off of the class time. Gives us 20 minutes. And then 20 minutes a day we spend on looking at exam type questions, different kinds of questions. I'm also thinking an integral part of that would be that there are devotees in this class who have skills in English. Either it's natural to them or they've had training or whatever. So my humble suggestion, which is open for you to decide, is that we have different leaders. When we look at, in that 20 minutes, we work in groups. We answer certain questions. And we have different leaders for the group, and they will have a couple of devotees that they will help in this regard of how to write English properly, how to format an essay like that. Whatever question we have for the day. So tell me what you think. I've sort of looked at the groups in terms of mindsets and interests and relationships that are already there and everything. And also where I feel that it would be nice exchanges, it would mean a lot of growth personally and philosophically. So I thought, Parvati, if you could look after Govinda and Tusti. This is within class, no extra time, within class. If you could help Govinda and Tusti. Uh-huh. Yeah. And then Ananda Vrindavan, if you could take care of Bettina and Amrita and Sushma. Okay? Sushma is here. So if you could take care of these three girls. Rukmavati, if you could help Satyavati and Gazelle. Okay? Also because I feel that you have potential to teach, or you're already teaching or you have potential to teach. Yashoda Mayi, if you can take care of Ananda Mayi and Analakshita. This is Analakshita and Ananda Mayi. Okay? And Tapaswini, if you can look after Avadhut Priya and Subhangada. Okay? And Lila Madhuri, if you can work with Chandra Gaba, Bhaga. Well, I figure you two can help each other. No, what I'm saying, you two can work together. It's not a leader, just the two of you work together. Now, two things. Are we happy to work in teams like this? And second thing, are we happy to give up the kirtan, cut the lesson a bit short, and give 20 minutes a day for working on getting ourselves up to standard for the exam? So I'll take vote, just put your hand up strongly. Take two separate votes on this. Who? Yeah. Oh, sorry, I should ask for questions first. Yeah. Both. Both. I'm putting you with people that also know something of the philosophy and can help you. Or they may not know so much of the philosophy, but someone who doesn't know English knows the philosophy. So I've tried to work the groups so there's a nice balance. And you can discuss things productively in your group. Is that okay? Any other question? I think you should do the exam. I think it's a cop-out not to do the exam. Have a good look at why you're not doing the exam. I want to talk about that in a minute. That's not a good excuse. I won't take that as an excuse. We'll look at that, the angle of verses, in a minute. No, in that 20 minutes you'll just be working in your groups. I'll be walking around. If there's any questions, you need some help from me, I'll be there to help you. But it'll be just developing the group so that you can start to help each other and formulating actual answers for exams, getting practice, doing practice work. I think if it's okay with you, for the first week we'll do it this system, and then we'll have assess it and see how we can improve it. Is that okay? Yeah, Rukma Bari? But I'm actually feeling that there's a little. What I'm feeling here is, what do you call it? An inverted ego is at work here, and also I think that this will help you focus. I think this will help you focus. Anyway, let's leave it for here. Is that okay? Yeah? Uh-huh. I've been doing that. I've been doing that.
I appreciate that, but I'm saying that part of the dynamics of the teaching is that he was sure of that himself.
Mm-hmm.
He could assess that when he walked out the door,
mm-hmm.
every single one of them had this level of his being.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, to think that we have a subgroup, as I'm putting it
I tell you quite frankly, I think there is an underestimation of what we can do in the groups. There's too much reliance on me as teacher. I have been giving, in terms of very systematically, the study. I've given you 3 or 4 weeks of that. Now I want you to start to try and fly your own plane. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be walking around the groups. But I want you to grow. I want you to develop your own skills in this regard. Give it a try. Yeah. Yeah. And writing it. Yeah. Writing the answers. I think when you start something new, there's always fears. Especially if you're not confident yourself. But just be a little peaceful. There's no examination on what we're doing. We're just piloting something to see if we can help devotees come up to a higher standard by the time of exam, so they're more confident, more competent. You know, they've got the skills. All right? One thing to get the class, but if the students don't have the skills to deal with the information, what's the value? This has been my anxiety this last week. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. It has to be a team effort. It'll add another dimension, this group, this will be very powerful. Let's see how it goes. We'll start it tomorrow. Okay? What's that? Oh, sorry. Okay, let's vote on it. I'm steamrolling. Okay, so who likes the idea of having 20 minutes a day for trialing this for 1 week? Okay. And you want a half an hour? Who wants to do it for half an hour, not 20 minutes for a trial? You're outvoted, kid. Okay, 20 minutes. Start with 20 minutes. What's that? I'll be coming around and seeing what's happening. We'll start with short question answers first, so that you can do them quickly, and then it won't be so much of a headache. And then we'll move into the small essays, then into the long essays. We'll do it systematically. Okay, so we're going to... And who's is everybody happy with the groups? Everyone's happy with the groups? Anyone who's not happy? Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. So, I want to talk to you a little bit now. You always have a question.
Does that mean that we come read class and then talk a question?
No. What it means is that, like I've been giving you the questions, right? For every chapter, isn't it? And I've been telling you where the questions are from. Okay. So when you come to class, we'll do the Mangalacharana, all that kind of stuff. Then I'll give my talk on what's the topic for today, that day. Any questions, we'll do like normal. We'll probably have to have a little bit less interaction work after that. And the last thing we'll do is this 20 minutes on the questions. Okay, so we'll start from chapter 2, the short questions that I gave you. We'll take the first section for tomorrow. So, have to know, the things you have to know. Okay, so already you've got the questions. You don't have to know the answers, because you're going to have 20 minutes. You've got the source, you've got the question, you're going to have 20 minutes to go to the source, read it. It doesn't mean any extra homework. Okay? Just means in class, 20 minutes, you have to systematically work.
So these questions, which category of short exam questions, short essay?
There are two things are there. One is the knowledge and recall, the short ones, which is what we'll work on for the first week, just to get you used to the system. Some of them are also understanding questions, which is short essay, half-page essay. But to start with, for the first week, we'll just do short questions. One, so you can get some confidence in what you're doing, and you can work with the dynamics of the groups more than with the topic itself. Settle the thing down. So then it can get on to more dynamic things the next week. Is it okay? Yeah. Because we don't have a lot of time. Chapter 1 is very, very simple. Is it okay? I think you can handle that one on yourself, by yourself. Okay. Yeah. Mood and mission is something that we'll do in these 20-minute groups. But later, a little later. First I want to do the short questions so you get confidence in yourself and in the group that you're doing something very constructive and useful. And when that comes, then we'll start to work on these other things. If you put too many difficult things together at once, it creates confusion. Uh-huh. What do you mean by the other topics? Those things. I'm going to talk a little bit about that now. They don't need a lot of talking. Yeah. We'll talk about that kind of thing now. Okay, so we've only got 10 minutes, so I'll move quite quickly. There will be four papers. They'll each be worth 25%. Okay? So at the end of each module of Bhagavad Gita, that means at the end of chapter 9 and the end of chapter 18, both times there will be four examinations. They're very simple, actually. I put them separately so you can just concentrate on different things on different days. So the four papers will be weighted 25% each. Okay? Only one of those papers is closed book. Only the first paper, Knowledge and Recall, that is closed book. The other three papers, you bring your Bhagavad Gita. No notes, no extra writing in the book. You may be underlining and making a few notes. That's okay. But bear in mind that anybody who's caught cheating in the test, this was stressed very strongly in the meeting, anyone who's caught cheating in the test will be immediately expelled from VIHE. Immediately expelled. Because this is brahminical work. Has to be honesty. It's a basic quality of brahminical life. Okay? So bear that in mind. You can bring your Gita. Should be your best friend within a few more weeks. Huh? What's that? Yeah, it's no problem. Yeah, that's no problem. If there's a few notes you've just written for interest or you've got underlining with yellow pens and stuff, that's not a problem. But, you know, if I find I open up the back page and you've got all the, you know, like all the themes written down there, it's like this. Bit off, you know. Okay. So three papers are open book. There's no worry with those papers. Only one paper is closed book. It's the first one. So this first one, it will be 25 short questions. That means they're only worth 3 marks each. They're very simple, straightforward questions. List, how many modes there are. Define the karma, akarma. You know, like that. Simple stuff, just straight from the book stuff. We are giving you 6 minutes per question. Per question. So you have plenty of time if you want to chant around in between because your mind fuzzes up. You've got plenty of time to do it. No problem. Okay. The slokas, there's only 5 slokas. And they are worth only 5 marks each. This is 25 questions worth 3 marks each and 5 slokas. No, it's extra, worth 5 marks each. Sanskrit and English. No need for diacritics. We want the Sanskrit as it is, the English as it is. By memory. But I want to say one thing for the old ladies in the group and those who've got no brain, like me. Okay, if you don't learn the slokas at all because you have no mind for Sanskrit, you just cannot cope with it. If you don't learn the slokas at all and you put the extra energy that you could have used there into learning the philosophy, right, and understanding that more deeply, you can still get a credit. You can still get a credit. You can still do well in the test. Because 75% is for the 25 questions. 25%. Pardon? Oh. I guess 50%, but I'll check. 65? Anyway, it's not so difficult. So 75% are for the 25 questions. 25% is for the slokas. But you have to remember these percentages are only a quarter of the total. There are 4 papers. Each will be graded for 100%. Then we will divide by 4. So these slokas, just to put those at rest who have some fear of slokas, okay? These slokas are a quarter of a quarter of the paper. Don't be in anxiety about it. This is called responsibility for learning. It's called responsibility for learning. What can I do? What can't I do? Where can I best spend my time? If you want to be a Bhakti Shastri teacher, you want to do it all prakha and everything like that, you should learn the slokas. You should do everything prakha. But if you've come for sarusanga, you've come to know Prabhupada's books, become attached to Prabhupada's books, Sanskrit drives you crazy, you can't memorize like this, don't do it. Don't do it. Spend that extra time on the philosophy. This is called responsibility for learning. Taking control of our own lives, control of our own learning. Huh? And doing it. The sloka? No, the slokas will be chosen. We will choose them. And they will be from the slokas on that list I gave you. You took the photocopy of? The ones in the first 9 chapters. The slokas in the first 9 chapters. What's that? No, no. You purchased a copy of key verses from me, right? It's about 26 verses. About 13 or 14 of them are in the first 9 chapters. So 13 or 14 verses are there for the first 9 chapters. If your ambition is to do Shastric teaching or something like that, or you have a natural aptitude for learning Sanskrit and memorizing verses, go for it. If it's not, think very carefully how you want to spend your time, how your time can be best spent. No, you don't need word for word. One minute, please. Excuse me. We don't have a lot of time. The other thing that I want to say about verses, for those who do want to do the verses, is that it's a good idea to practice writing the verses at least 15, 20 minutes a day. Because as preachers, we may be using verses all the time. But I know for myself, I found it really tough when I had to do it from speaking it to writing it. I spoke to Narayani last year about it, and she advised me a couple of weeks before the exam to start writing the verses, and it helped me incredibly. Because it's a whole different thing of writing and speaking. So just practicing 15 minutes a day, Sanskrit, English, Sanskrit and English. Okay, so no need for diacritics. And with these 25 questions, I'm going to give you chapter headings. So you're going to know which chapter they're from. Okay, it's not that it's just going to be a bunch of 25 questions. You've got to figure out where I have to answer this from. Many of the questions come up in different chapters with different emphases. Okay, so I'll give you chapter headings. So you know, chapter 2, these questions. Chapter 3, these questions. Be very, very clear for the knowledge questions and for the other questions. On the other questions, you'll have your book. It won't be necessary. You'll have open book. The second paper, which will be Understanding, Personal and Preaching Application. This is open book. No, this means the first exam. It will be the September 19th to September 22nd, one paper a day. So you don't get stressed out. Some of us have bad backs. Some of us get migraines under too much pressure. So it's just short papers. One paper will be 3 hours. The others will be 1.5. So the second paper is Understanding, Personal and Preaching Application. So this will be open book. And it'll be 3 questions. You'll have a choice of questions.
How many questions?
3 questions. You'll have a choice of questions. And we're expecting no more than 3/4 of a page. Now we're making a special concession for devotees who have second language English problems, or who are first language English but don't have any experience in writing essays. You can write in point form. You can write in point form. I know some devotees, when they start writing an essay, it ends up 10 pages. It takes them a long time to get to the point, right? So you have an option. You can just write the essay if you are very lucid, very clear, and you know your mind works like that. You can keep it very clear. Or you can just write the point form. But the points have to be make sense. They have to be systematic, obviously. Okay, so that option is there. Yeah. No more than 3/4 of a page. 3/4. This is for the short essay. Okay?
And this is like 3 essays?
3 essays in 2 hours. It means you have over 40 minutes to write this much 3 times. It's a lot of time. We're not putting any pressure on you. Open book, plenty of time. The third paper, which is Mood and Mission, Academic Integrity, Authority, and Shastra Chakshus, that's also open. One question will be mudan mission. That will be compulsory. You have a choice within it, but that will be a compulsory question. There are only two questions in this paper. You have 2 hours to write two questions, two answers. Very simple. One of them will be compulsory mudan mission. The second one, you'll have a choice. Academic integrity means we may give you an example where a verse is being misused and ask you to explain how you think it's being misused, how would you use it properly, like that. Authority means you just use Shastra to support what you're saying. You use Shastra to support what you're saying, not I think, but Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 4:34 like this. It's very simple things. There's big words, but they don't really mean so much this way big. Shastra Chakshus means we may give you a circumstance and ask you to comment on it from Bhagavad Gita, what you've learned in Bhagavad Gita. For example, I might say, today is Radhastami, and in this morning's class, you heard about the qualities of Radharani. And one of the qualities of Radharani is that she's kind to old people. So you're out on a book distribution marathon for Radharani's pleasure on her birthday. And you see this old lady struggling really hard across the road with very heavy shopping bags. So you remember what you heard in the class in the morning, that Radharani is very kind to old ladies. So you decide you'll help this old lady across the road. So you go up to her and you ask, you know, to offer to help her carry her bags. And she's very happy. And you, as you go to take the bags, you realize they're full of meat. She's just been to the butcher's. Right? So, how would you deal with this in terms of chapter 3 and 5 of Bhagavad Gita? This is open book. You've got the chapters there in front of you to have a look at. Just an idea of the kind of thing you could expect. Pardon? Yes, yeah, same kind of thing. The question I gave you about the Gurukul situation, the Gurukul boy that had the problem with 518 verse, the one we did for a preaching application, we had that one for the demigod worship we did. It's pretty simple. It's not heavy stuff. You're remembering too much your medical exams. Huh? Okay. And then the fourth paper will be a choice of two papers. We're going to give you the full range. There'll be a full range of topics of all the themes that you study this term. There'll be 8 themes that we study. You have to do 2. I'm suggesting that you study 4 because our angle on the theme you might not relate to. So better to have 4 prepared so that you're covered. Okay? So these, we're going to give, it's unrestricted. Minimum unrestricted. We have restricted time. You can write 2 essays in 2 hours. Minimum 1 page we want you to write. Again, it can be in note form or in essay form. But it's unrestricted. If you want to read more, if you want to write more, that's fine. More the merrier on this one. If you know a lot and you want to say a lot, good. It may be the deciding factor between a credit and an honours. Okay, this is where you get to say what you really know, sort of thing. Yeah. Yeah. Anything that you find that comes up in the theme, if it say it's like you only have to choose 4 themes out of the 8. So if you find in those 4 that you choose, there's information in other chapters that we haven't covered yet, have a look at those. See if they're what you want to include in your essay. If they are, use them. You don't have to know them by heart. You just have to know the reference, because that exam is an open book exam. So if you just remember, for example, demigod worship, okay, the references I need are 3:11, 12, 4:12, 7, 20 to 23, 9, 20 to 25. If I know, if I've got those 4, if I can remember those 4 for that theme, I can write an essay. Open book. We had to do a closed book last year. All together. It's fun. We're being very kind to you this year. Yeah. You won't have your theme book with you. No, only Bhagavad Gita. Okay? Well, I can appreciate what you're saying. I would prefer to do it in the groups. If we don't find that that's successful, or we run out of time, then we'll do what you're saying. But I feel that we'll be able to do it in the groups. See how it goes. See how it goes. Yeah. That's why I want you practicing daily. I want you practicing daily. And I want you working with other intelligence. You see? The Western concept of education is very individualistic. Because the whole system is like that. You stand alone. But that's not Vedic. The model I gave you this morning of working in groups, this is what happens in Vedic Gurukuls. You have one teacher. She has students that have some expertise in a particular area. They become the teachers of other students within that group. And that's why the Gurukul system is so effective, because it's cooperative. It's pooling the intelligence and learning from each other. I'm going to be there in the group if it's needed, no problem. But if it's not needed, you may find that within your group you have perfect synergy. Things are happening nicely. It will take a little while to get off the ground. Give it some time. But if you put your mind to it, it'll work well. I've tried it before. I've worked it before. It's a very effective way of learning a lot in a little time. Sharpening up also. For sharpening up, it's very good. Is it okay? Yeah, the themes will be two essays, but prepare for. Because we may give an angle of vision on one question that doesn't suit the way you prepared for it. We may give it in a way you don't feel comfortable to answer it. So if you have the four done, you'll cover it. You won't have a problem. We'll give you eight, but they'll be from different angles of vision on the different themes. So it's better to prepare four than two. Because then you can choose, when you see the questions, you can choose which two best work with the questions. So then you just cut that one out. Okay, I've got something else I can do. It's always, this is part of Brahminical nature. Brahminical nature is always planning ahead. Always planning ahead. Seeing possible problems and dealing with them before they become problems. Then you don't have any problems. Okay? Shudra mentality is you just keep bumbling along and dealing with the problems as they come. Huh? But we're not shudrans. The activity we're doing is not shudran, it's brahminical. So brahminical means I see in the future that this may be a problem, so I deal with it now so it doesn't become a problem. That's Brahman, Brahmani. No, this is what I'm saying about responsibility for learning. There are two kinds of vision. I'm going over time. Is that okay with people? It's okay? Tell me when you're fed up. There's two kinds of vision. One is visionary. It sees the goal and it doesn't see the obstacles. And one is circumstantial. It only sees the obstacles. Right? So what I'm trying to project is a more visionary understanding of things. I'm trying to increase your taking responsibility for learning instead of finding excuses for not learning. All right? So, okay, you don't have a mind for numbers. No problem. You just have to learn, okay, these are the themes I want to do. You write them down now. And you don't worry about the exact references because they're numbers and the mind doesn't relate to numbers. But you say, okay, demigod worship, there's stuff in the third chapter that's important, the fourth, the seventh and the ninth. So you just remember, okay, these four chapters are the four chapters I can get my information out of. You're going to have time in the exam to have a look through those. You have an index in your Bhagavad Gita. It will have demigod worship there for sure. Isn't it? You know, so why, you know, don't put impositions on yourself that are not necessary. Okay? You have an index. You don't have an index, okay? You better get another Gita. You can borrow my Gita. Okay. Is there any more questions on this? Everyone's happy? Yeah? Okay. Please accept my benefit.